Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I am absolutely honored to be joined today by Dr. Jean Dodds. And Dr. Jean Dodds is very well known, I think, in the purebred dog community for the work that she's done with vaccines, with thyroid, with all kinds of amazing stuff. So welcome, Jean. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Absolutely exciting stuff. So I think this morning what we are going to talk about a little bit is what I think sort of started it all, right? Hemopet and the blood banking?
Yes.
Absolutely. So talk to us about, quickly a little bit, your background, your history with medicine, and what brought you to establishing the blood bank.
Okay. I graduated as a veterinarian when women were not necessarily welcome in the profession, so it was rather a challenge. And in order to get into veterinary college at the Ontario Veterinary College at the time, you had to have perfect grade marks, which, of course, being brash and determined of what I was going to do with my life, it never worried me. I just figured whatever they want to put in front of me, I'll do it. So I did it. And awesome. Graduated in 1964, and they only accepted the number of girls, women, that graduated that year in the next year. So if two women were in the class, they would admit two in the freshman class. If they were four, they would admit four. I mean, it was So we had 64 graduates in 1964, and there were six women. The year before that, they had been fewer. Anyway, what happened was I decided that I wasn't going to do clinical veterinary medicine. I was going to do clinical research medicine following my family background, which is in nursing and in medicine. The ladies in nursing, of course, and at that time, and the men in medicine. So I needed a job in the freshman year because I wasn't going to take a bursary to put myself through school because I was in Ontario. It was a subsidized school in Ontario. Okay. I wasn't taking any money from my family. I was going to earn my own way through being independent at that time. So I did medical illustrations during the noon hour and after hours. And then I cared for the animals at the research farm. And as it turned out, they were animals born with hemophilia and other bleeding diseases. And they were cared for the rest of their natural lives. And all we did was study their blood and the molecular biology of what was going on with hemophilia as a model for the human condition. So obviously, I got involved in blood and immune function and all the other things.
That is fascinating. I love that.
So in 1964, after I graduated, I took over running this colony of animals and looking after them at the highly ethical standards that I would demand. And then all of a sudden, the Canadian government ran out of American research dollars because Americans correctly decided, why should our taxpayers' dollars fund research in Canada? Why don't they fund their own? Well, in fact, that was correct. There was a link, right? A gap until Canada could come up. Money. So I had two choices. I could stay in Canada and starve, or I could move to the United States and take some of the animals and the money with me and keep it. It's just what I did in 1965. So I moved to Albany, New York, and I was there doing clinical research in hematology with my NIH research dollars and looking after the animals. And it was then that we met Genentech, who had decided that they had a method of purifying recombinant clotting factor from human blood to avoid AIDS and blood transfusion transmitted diseases, et cetera, that were becoming prevalent at the time. And they said, we need some way to prove that this is efficacious in a clinical model. And how do you do that without a hemophilic animal? Well, we had them. Huh. So Genentech sent a scientist that looked like Tom Selleck with gold product to Albany, New York, to do a transfusion. And you can infuse heterologous proteins, Laura, once or twice within 10 days before you get a reaction because it's a different species.
Wow.
So we knew it would work the first time, and we informed consent and all that, mm-hmm. and we used a boxer named Blue. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we picked him because he was the most tractable, friendly one. And I was thinking afterwards, my God, what if he got sick and had a reaction? And our favorite one would be no longer with us. Well,
oh my
anyway,
gosh.
My veterinary nurse, who was also a human nurse, and I, Dottie, transfused this little tiny fraction, about a teaspoon of liquid gold, into Blue. And we told Tom Selleck, that's not his real name, stay close to Blue because Blue didn't know him and he might be nervous. So he had to stay in the corner of the treatment room. So Dottie and I did the transfusion and we got about half of it through and Blue stopped breathing.
Oh my gosh.
And we thought, oh my God. But we did triage, you know, we had everything ready, what to do, and we just waited. And it took about 45 seconds, and he started breathing normally again.
Wow.
So we finished the transfusion, and we had cut a toenail short and let little drops of blood go on a gauze pad before we transfused him. And then we, of course, stopped it with pressure. Mm. 6 minutes after the transfusion, Laura, we cut another toenail short, and we got one tiny drop of blood and some serum.
Wow.
And he went back to Genentech with that to the investors to say, it worked.
That is incredible. That is an amazing story.
Yeah. And for 48 hours, Laura, Blue got to play with a tennis ball and do whatever he wanted because he couldn't hurt himself. Anyway, to make a long story short, I then became involved over the 27 years that I worked there to be in charge of the blood program and blood safety and regulations that were promulgated through Albany, New York for the entire state of New York. And I was going to the Red Cross advisory meetings and the medical school advisory meetings at a time when AIDS and blood safety and homophobia and everything was rampant.
Right.
And what I decided coming home one night from an advisory committee meeting, because I was there monitoring it for the state, I said, gosh, why don't we have a blood bank for animals? Why don't we just do the same thing? I already do that. We have a blood bank to keep our hemophilic animals alive. So why couldn't I do that for pets?
Wow.
And I thought, I'm driving home and I said, I'm going to make it a heart-shaped life preserver in red, white, and blue, and I'm going to call it Pet Lifeline, which is still our logo.
Yes.
So then I decided, but we need a more medical name for the company. Blood for Pets. Hema-pet, Hemo-pet. Hema doesn't sound right. It's going to be Hemo-pet. And that's what happened.
That is fabulous. And so what brought you to California to do this project?
Oh, listen, I had been in New York, an independent lady for a long, long time. And I met this wonderful man named Charles Berman, who was a patent attorney expert for Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Beverly Hills to maintain the patents for Cedars over prior art from England on cattle, factor VIII concentrates for hemophilic people made from bovine blood.
Wow.
And the Japanese patent office said that was prior art and they would not uphold the patents that Cedars-Sinai held. So I had to go to Japan as a woman expert, that's just not so easy,
No. And
defend Cedars-Sinai's patent against prior art from England. And the funny thing about it is, if you want to get money to study the cow as an animal model of human hemophilia, you say they're the same. If you want to prove that the patent for the cow is not the same as the one for people, you say they're different.
Oh my
anyway,
gosh.
We won a patent fight, and I decided to heck with this patent stuff. I think I like this guy. So we fell in love, and this was in 1982, and we knew each other for more than 2 years. And I moved to California in 1986, and we were married that December, and we've been married ever since and are very happy.
And is he with you in Italy right now?
Yeah, absolutely. He's sitting out the window writing a patent on his laptop.
Oh my gosh. That pretty much describes the dream world, doesn't it? Good job. Good job, Gene. Oh, I love it. Okay, so moving on. So you established Hemopet and you established the animal blood bank. And so tell us exactly what blood banking is for our pets and why is it important?
Well, it's really, really important that we have the same opportunities. You know, this is a one medicine world that we're in right now. There's one health and one medicine. So what we have for people, we want to have for animals. And As you know, there are many companion animals that have special needs for transfusions from trauma or surgery or even a heritable trait like hemophilia, just like people have. And we have to do the same thing, and we have exactly the same requirements. And so with my background in protecting the human health through safe blood banking, I knew we had to set up the same guidelines for animals using the American Association of Blood Bank standards that we then developed to apply for first the dog and then the cat. And of course, now we have small blood banks for horses and occasionally for cattle and sheep, but mostly for dogs and cats. And in order to do that, we had to determine what the average blood type spectrum was for the dog, because we knew that we had to look for what's called a universal donor dog. Right. Like an O in a person.
Like an O, right. Okay.
Correct. Because most veterinarians and pet owners in emergencies have no idea what the blood type of their patient is. And if they've got a condition that's going to require transfusions more than once in their lifetime, they have to know what the blood type is in order to make sure there's compatible blood.
And so I'm sorry to interrupt you, Gene, but this is fascinating to me. Can you give us a little bit of an idea, maybe put it in a comparison, the blood types of, say, dogs? I mean, yes. Do they have A, B, negative, O?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I have no idea. This is fascinating to me.
It started out calling the canine bank system A, B, and whatever. It got so confusing with the human that they changed the nomenclature from A to numbers.
Okay.
So it became dog erythrocyte antigen, DEA. And then the blood type would be 1, type 1, type 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, et cetera, type 2, and then all the way up to 9.
Wow.
And there are 14 different subtypes within that, but there are only really 2 that have major clinical importance and another 2 that have minor clinical importance. And so the problem is that 40% of random dogs will have a blood type that is negative, a little bit like A, but not clean enough, mm-hmm. where 60% are positive. So the problem arises if you've got a negative mother and a positive father. In other words, the bitch is negative and the father is positive, and you can end up getting hemolytic disease of the newborn, just like you would in a person.
Wow.
So we have to look for universal donors that are negative for the major DEA 1.1 and DEA 1.2 antigens. There's a second system called TR, which is DEA 7, and that's a 50-50 chance. So you've got a 50% chance of being negative and a 50% chance of being positive on the background of the 40 to 60. So you see how it breaks down. You don't have that many true universal O's. Now, what's weird about the DEA 7 system is that it doesn't cause an acute transfusion reaction, but it makes the blood survival when you've transfused it be much shorter. So instead of lasting for up to 40 days, once you've given the transfusion, the red blood cells can be destroyed in 20 days.
Wow.
And obviously you don't want that, because it's a issue with benefit, clinical benefit for the patient, and also cost, right? And availability.
Right, right.
And there's a national shortage of blood products that are properly typed and cross-matched and free of infectious diseases for pets.
This is such a fascinating topic. I love this. So I want to continue on this conversation, but let me insert here. So as a practical recommendation to our listeners, do you recommend that everyone find out the blood type of their dog? I mean, this is just whole new theory to me.
Well, you know, we're starting to have like a passport for dogs now, where we know everything about them, right? Including their microchip or however tattoo or whatever mm-hmm. they have.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they can do, and by the way, the country of Italy, believe it or not, requires for their purebred dog passports that blood type be included. And there's 10,000 or more dogs registered in the country of Italy by blood type. And in fact, a Peruvian veterinarian who's studying her PhD at the University of Pisa, Dr. Medina, just spent a month with us. And she and her mentor, whom I know, he's an animal geneticist, George Lubas, just published, or has been accepted, it's not in print yet, a major publication on the blood types in Italy. And they've actually found certain provinces of Italy where inbreeding and line breeding is stronger. And the animals in those two provinces, Piedmont and Lombardy, I think they were, are more alike in blood type and different from the rest of Italy. It's fascinating.
Interesting. That is fascinating stuff. I mean, literally fascinating.
Yeah, but we do that in America. It's not required.
Right.
So can people do that? Yes, they can. And there are blood typing kits that are available. They don't do everything, but they at least test for DEA 1.1 and 1.2. And so people should know that.
Right. And is it something like occasionally people will bank their own blood? Is it something that you should do for your pet? Is that something that people should think about? Yeah.
Directed donation and doing your own blood, it's not feasible really, because the red cells, even if they're properly prepared and separated from the liquid plasma part of the blood, will only last up to 46 days.
Okay.
And frozen red cells are really not yet practical. It's just too expensive, Laura.
Right.
Plasma, on the other hand, can be kept for up to 5 years. And many purebred dog people get plasma to have it on hand for their neonates, either from their own animals, if they've got large dogs, or they buy it from a place like ourselves, where we sell it in little tubes for neonates if they don't have colostrum or they're fading or whatever,
right,
so they can give them the antibodies they need. And then the other reason we bank therapeutic blood products is if, for example, you have a litter of herpes, God forbid, and the puppies die, the mother and any other adults in the household for about 3 months after that will have herpes virus antibodies in their blood. Mm. And so we have a protocol where we teach the veterinarians taking care of these animals to draw the blood, prepare the plasma, and freeze it so that the pet guardian can have it in the freezer when the next litter is due, in case, God forbid, herpes comes up again.
Wow. That is a side note that I definitely... We may have to add a session on the end of one of these in talking about herpes and bitches. I just went through a thing with a friend of mine, and this is a topic she really wanted covered. So note to myself, we're going to come back to that.
Well, the next problem, I guess, that we have to address is when I got out to California and I decided I would do that, my first naivete was to go to the pounds and shelters in Southern California, talk to the people about adopting their, remember, larger breed dogs are not as commonly adopted as the smaller ones from pounds and shelters. And many of them then don't survive, you know, they end up being put to sleep.
Right.
So I went to them and I said, if we kept the animals and paid for their care in optimum housing for 30 days, so we can take a unit of blood, a simple half pint, and then we'll advertise them as, please adopt Buddy because he gave his blood to save the lives of your other friends, and see if we could then improve the adoption of these animals. And it was a great idea, and it was accepted by the pounds and shelters in Southern California around Los Angeles. However, some of the people that donated money for these shelters, I call them euphemistically the little old ladies in tennis shoes, said, this is horrific. You're vampires. We never agree with.
Oh, my gosh.
So for public relations reasons only, they said, we can't do that.
Huh.
So now I'm thinking, what can I do? What can I do? And I thought, oh, I've got it. Greyhounds. And there's no greyhound racing in California. There hadn't been since 1926. So I said, well, what are we going to do? What about Arizona right next door? What about Texas? What about Oklahoma? And they said, what about Florida? Well, that's too far away, because we had to be sure that if we were adopting animals that were unsuitable for the racing industry or retired from the racing industry, and we would adopt them, of course, after they'd been with us for a short period, we had to be sure that they could arrive healthy, fed and watered, and they wouldn't suffer being transported to us, because that would be awful. So we developed a contract first with Tucson and Phoenix, and then we went into Texas, Dallas, Houston, that area. Mm-hmm. Then we went into Oklahoma. So we get our animals from those places now. And you know what's really neat about it? We have to test them all for infectious diseases first.
Right.
Then we test those that pass for blood type. The ones that don't pass the blood type have already had infectious disease screening that we've paid for, and they're much more easily adopted by other greyhound rescue groups because they don't have the wherewithal to do that. Not that we have a lot, but we have to do this, you know, for our regulations and our license. And then we take the ones that we can adopt into our program because they're true universal donors, and they're free of every infectious disease known to dogs at this time, including the leishmaniasis that came into the foxhound colonies in the Northeast. We test for that now.
Wow.
So every time you do that, it costs about $200 to screen a male and $250 to screen a female before they can come into our program. And many of them have not yet been neutered or spayed. So we have to do that as well. Mm. So just bringing animals into the program is costly, but we have to do that to be able to have new animals so that the ones we have are going to be adopted as family companions.
Right. And so how many, just average, you bring in a new X number of new animals and adopt out X number of new animals? What kind of a turnover do we see?
We have 250 dogs in our colony at all times, plus or minus 200 to 250. We bring in animals usually every 3 weeks. And depending on whether they pass or not, it could be 9 animals or 20 animals. So we really don't know until we've tested the group, and we take them all. We'd never turn any away.
Sure.
And we adopt out every week 4 or 5, roughly.
Wow, that's amazing. So an opportunity for people, if they're looking for a pet, a great opportunity to adopt a new greyhound.
Right. They have to be in our area, and they have a very strict adoption application form, and they have to have the right kind of yard and et cetera, et cetera. If they have other pets or cats, they have to meet the greyhound that we've helped them select so that we make sure they're compatible. And we have a special meeting place called the Love Shack.
Aww.
Where they know each other. And then the people come and they work with the animals, 1 or 2 greyhounds they're going to adopt. Sometimes people take a pair. Mm. So the animals know them very well. So when they go home, nothing really strange about the people they're going to interact with, just the home location.
Right, right. Because these are typically animals that have not lived in a home environment. So that's a new process for them, I would assume. Right.
They adapt incredibly well. Greyhounds are really, really good. The only thing you can't do is leave them alone, because they bond to you instantly and they trust you. And then if you go to work after 2 weeks off to adjust your new pet to your home, you then go back to work and you come home and they've chewed everything. The couch, the doors, the lamps,
dear.
Hopefully not electrocuted themselves, God forbid.
You know, right.
Knocked over the television. They've done everything because they go into a panic mode.
Wow.
So you have to have them confined usually in these large open Great Dane size crates,
right,
with their special toys and food and water. And then usually we put a crate cover over part of it so they feel safe. Mm-hmm. And we train them to go into that as their home by leaving the door open all the time, encouraging them to go to their home.
Yeah.
And then when we go to work, we close the front and keep them there until they come home. And they adapt very, very well. They know they're secure there, and that mom and dad will be home soon.
Oh, that's great. And so going back briefly to discuss the blood banking again, talk about, I mean, obviously hemophilia, obviously traumatic situation. So again, specific information for our listeners in terms of how do they contact HemaPet? How does the vet contact HemaPet? What additional types of situations are they going to be looking at using this resource?
Yeah, anything, even puppies with hookworm anemia or immune-mediated hemolytic disease, or where there's no platelets and there's bleeding. I mean, rodenticide poisoning, right? Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of issues, liver disease, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it's www.hemopet.org.
And we will put a link on our website in the show notes so that people can just go directly to that.
Yeah, go on our website, look at all the banners. You can have a virtual tour of our facility. You can email us at any time with any questions. And veterinarians are well aware of our program. And we have repositories throughout the major cities in the United States and also in Hong Kong, where our blood products are kept right there all the time. So that if you're in Chicago, you don't have to wait for us to ship it to you. We have 3 repositories in the greater Chicago area, where the emergency 24-hour specialty clinics stock the product all the time. And if a local veterinarian needs it, they send someone over to pick it up.
Wow.
And nobody pays for the product until it's used, because there's a shortage all the time. We carefully portion out the amounts depending on the population catchment area of where the repositories would be, in Dallas or in Houston right now with,
right,
the, God forbid, flooding, you know?
Right.
So we do it that way.
And now tell me, Jean, there was some recent, within the last couple of years, I remember seeing some information about potentially some legislative concern in California regarding the blood bank. And can you talk a little bit about that and how that has been resolved, we hope?
Oh, it has not. It's a disaster. Mm. In 1993, I went to the state of California legislature to get blood banks exempted from taxation, because all of a sudden, after we'd been in operation for 2.5 years, they wanted to tax the value, perceived value of the dogs, the kennels, the food, the people, the floor, whatever. And I got the Board of Equalization to agree in 1993, we had a welfare exemption and we didn't have to pay tax. However, relatively recently, some smarties trying to get more money into the government coffers decided that isn't really applied to sales tax, only to personal property tax. So you have to pay sales tax, which we've not paid for 23 years. Mm-hmm. And every time they came and inspected us, they said everything was 100% hunky-dory. Blood banks are medical emergency services. Right. Services are not taxable. In 1965, human blood banks in the state of California were exempt from all taxation as a service. So we invoked that 1965 legislation. And they said, oh, yeah, but there weren't any animal blood banks then, so it couldn't have applied to you. So we've been fighting this ever since. And we got a bill passed, SB 898, through both the Assembly and the Senate of California last year to exempt us permanently as a nonprofit medical emergency service from taxation. Well, the governor vetoed it along with 6 other bills because he said he didn't have any money, even though ours was a tiny bill in relation to all the other state organizations. And we got swept into this, and so it wasn't passed. So they're hounding us again, and they've already audited us twice and are harassing us, the Board of Equalization. And we've got another bill that we're hoping to submit to the legislature in 2019, that would be next year, mm-hmm. To try to do that. We've got new sponsors, new senators and assembly people trying to get us off the dime, maybe put it in even into the state budget so that it isn't an issue anymore, so the governor can't veto it. But we have no idea. I'll just tell you one thing. We are never giving them a cent. Never. We've exempted for 23 years, and we're not going to be legally bound to change that after all this time. It's established principle, established principle of estoppel, legally. Well, California doesn't recognize that, by the way.
Okay, so is there anything our listeners can do to support that effort?
At this point, no.
Okay.
But as soon as we know that we need it, we will broadcast out everywhere. We got over 1,000 letters bombarding the governor's office about our situation last year, and they were just fried with that. They couldn't handle it. So we can generate those letters, and all the associations in California associated with dogs, including the professional California dog club groups, mm-hmm. have all supported us. So we will just bring out the support again as soon as it's needed. You don't want to cry wolf until you absolutely have it, because otherwise it goes on deaf ears.
Right. Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you very much, Jean. I've quite enjoyed the conversation on the blood bank, and I'm looking forward to our additional conversations coming up. I know our listeners are as well. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, guys, don't go away. We have a special bonus with Jean Dodds on her book titled Canine Nutrigenomics, The New Science of Feeding Your Dog for Optimum Health. This is got some really great information I think you guys are all going to enjoy, so stick around for it. Thanks. Okay, so Jean, we've been talking about the holistic medicine and about how important diet is in keeping the dogs healthy. And you have an excellent book that was published by Dogwise called Canine Nutrigenomics, right? Did I do that right?
That's correct. That's the main title. There's a subtitle as well.
The New Science of Feeding Your Dog for Optimum Health, yes?
Correct. And Diana Lavradura and I, this is our second book. It was published in 2015, and I believe it's also a bestseller.
Excellent.
And our books have been written for the public, not for scientists necessarily, but all of the scientific background is in the book, in the reference sections. And so there's reference sections, there's resource sections, everything else. So the book actually is as comprehensive as a textbook, but the chapters are written in an understanding way for people that may not have that specific scientific background.
Right.
And nutrigenomics is an amazing concept, by the way, that wasn't coined until about 2003.
Wow.
It's the leading way of, remember we talked about holistic medicine and nutrition being the key to a healthy immune system and resistance to disease, and the fact that every individual has their own optimal nutrition genomically, and we're different from everybody else other than an identical twin. And so the concept of nutrigenomics is how nutrition plays a role in the expression of the genes within the genome. In other words, it's one of the key regulatory factors of how our genes express themselves, and we want them to do that in a good way.
Right.
In a bad, unhealthy, inflammatory way. So actually, in about 1998 and 1999, my husband and I wrote a series of patents on animal wellness and diagnostic testing of the future. And we developed the concept, I developed the concept of how individuals need to match their nutrition with their genetic makeup in order to optimize their health. And this is what became nutrigenomics. And people say, oh, well, did you found the field of nutrigenomics? And I said, no, not really. But I thought of the concept and embraced it, and I was actually at the Holistic National Meeting in Hawaii at the time when it came to me one day, and Charles said to me, what's going on in veterinary medicine in the next 10 to 20 years, Gene? Have you got any ideas? And I just sort of looked at my crystal ball, and I came up with these ideas. So we wrote this series of four patents, which actually launched the whole concept of nutrigenomics in veterinary medicine.
Amazing. And so if it wasn't for Dogwise, I'm assuming this isn't a book that you can just take to Penguin and say, hey, man, right? So it seems like Larry and Charlene really put themselves behind this publishing.
Well, actually, I met Charlene before I met Larry, and Charlene told me, by the way, anytime you want to write a book, please don't forget about us. We would be interested in publishing it. And so this was when Diane and I were writing our thyroid book. We thought, well, where should we publish it? Do we want to go to a mainstream publisher, or do we want to go to a publisher that is widely read by dog people or cat people? That was main focus on dog people. And we knew that it had to be a paperback book that was affordable and not a textbook that's going to sit on a shelf and look pretty. So we contacted Charlene, I did, and I said, hey, we're ready to write our first book. And that's what happened.
Oh, that is just amazing. I have to give my thanks to Larry and Charlene at Dogwise because they publish dog books that we all need. And I grew up in the Northwest, and of course, Charlene was selling dog books in the 80s and the 90s at dog shows. So that catalog that they started makes it so we all have that kind of access.
Right.
That we're not going to get it any other way if it isn't for the people in the fancy that support each other.
Exactly.
All right, guys. Thank Dr. Dodds for being such a great guest, and go order her book at dogwise.com. Dogwise has actually given Pure Dog Talk listeners a 20% discount. So you guys, that is amazing. And you just use a coupon code of Pure Dog Talk when you check out on the website. And if you have any questions, there's a phone number. And you can just call up Jason or Christy at Dogwise and they'll help you out. And so there you go. Dogwise.com. We'll have all the links in the website on the show notes. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.